when we're breathing, when we breathe in long, we notice the breath is long. When we breathe in short, we notice the breath is short. So short and long are relative, aren't they? So we could say for this group, 5 would be a long breath and 30 would be short breath, right? So if you said 30 in the 20s, I don't know, maybe 16 and above, well, that might be medium breath. So it's all a bit relative, isn't it? But it's something to just observe for yourself if you want to try it out another time after you meditate and just see, does it stay the same or does it change? Because day by day, you know, different times of day, different stresses in life, different distractions, it can change. But anyway, so that gives you some sort of thing, well, okay, if I have 5, I can be pretty sure I can call that a long breath. If I have 30, I can be pretty sure I can call that a short breath. And everything in between? Open to negotiation. Because in the end, it's relative to your own long or short, isn't it? So, something to experiment with. You can report back to each other. Okay, so, Buddhism and human rights, right? Okay. When I heard this topic, I thought, should we put, you know, I'd like to include human rights, animal rights, environmental rights, global rights, everybody's rights, and human responsibility. Because we have, you know, there's both the sense of rights and responsibilities. So I guess internationally it became a worldwide discourse in what, 1945, probably, when we had the UN Declaration on Human Rights, actually recognising that there were human rights, and that, of course, came on the back of what? War. And so we could assume that, therefore, war is one of those deprivations of rights. And since then, we've seen an escalation of wars, you know, the number of wars in the world. So having a declaration on human rights doesn't guarantee human rights, but it gives us some language to talk with. So that's at least one thing. And so I guess in terms of Buddhist practice, well, there's practice and then there's social engagement, because that is another way. And that particularly I can think of, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, when the Vietnam War was on. Well, Vietnam call it the US war, I think. Is anyone here Vietnamese? What do you call that war that happened in the 60s?
Against America war.
Against America war, yeah. So depending on where you positioned in the world, you're going to call it the Vietnam War, the US war against America war, and so forth. So but at that time, you know, that's where Thich Nhat Hanh realised that you had to be socially engaged and do people, well, he probably realised it before that, but set up a lot of projects to help people in war, you know, as a devoted Buddhist practitioner. So there are many, many projects that people get involved in terms of advocating for human rights or assisting people at those times of, particularly of war. I mean, as Buddhists, the thing that we aspire to is peace of mind, you know, have a, you know, totally serviceable mind, which means a mind undisturbed by whatever happens around us. In other words, internally, the mind is without disturbance. Long way to go, because that's the biggest thing. No matter what's happening around us, the biggest thing is how we react, respond, and so forth to what's around us. So that's ultimately what we're aiming towards. And, you know, we talk about peace in the world. You know, I was found it intriguing when, after the 9/11 thing, that the US declared war for peace. Sort of was sounding a bit contradictory to my ears. Extremely contradictory, because if you go back in history, I challenge you to name any war that has ended in lasting peace. If you have one, let us know, because, you know, maybe it's a way. But so far, violence only leads to violence. So it's not the way to be able to create world peace. You know, the Dalai Lama has said recently, and he probably said it previously, I'm sure other teachers have as well, that if we really want peace in the world, if you teach every child in school to meditate, just like we did, on the breath, within a generation, we'll have peace in the world. Now, it sort of sounds simple, doesn't it? Why can't we do that? Why can't we as a global citizenship do that? Because increasingly, like particularly, well, the 20th century and now the 21st century, we are globally interdependent. If anyone ever thought they were just their isolated little community and culture and so forth, their culture's probably dead. Because, you know, there's forever been trade, there's forever been crossover and so forth. So the global interdependence, what we do here and how that impacts on other parts of the world and vice versa. We all know about that. You only have to turn on and listen to the news, don't you? And it's all about what's happening in different countries and so forth. I've just been in America, so I didn't listen to the news. I found it too overwhelming to listen to the news, American style. It's like too much. That's not a creator of peace to my mind. So there's one thing about being socially engaged. So then we look at, well, what does the Buddhist... I mean, the Buddha spoke a lot about environment. And if all of the Buddha's teachings come down to what two things? Do no harm and subdue your mind, calm your mind. Because one affects the other. So do no harm is with what you say and what you do. And, you know, subdue your mind is when you're not with others, look at what's happening in your mind. And I'm pointing here, but we all know our mind isn't necessarily here. It's just, you know, it's not the brain. Okay, it's the mind, which is, you know, that's another debate. We won't go there because that will be a whole night just on that. So the thing is to cultivate internally that what we would like to see in the world around us. You know, it's how we use aspiration for everything. You know, we set goals. You know, an architect will set a goal and say, I want this building to look like this. You know, the architect of this building knew exactly what it would look like if it was built according to the specifications. So we all have those sorts of goals and aspirations. And for myself, you know, just in the morning when I wake up, my motivation for the day is may everything I think, say and do be of benefit to others. I won't guarantee you that everything I do, think, say and do will be of benefit to others, but I'm setting my mind in that direction at the beginning of the day, and then I have to reset it numerous times throughout the day because it's sort of... Because then it's like, oh, what's for breakfast? You know, no. You know what I mean? It's an internal dialogue, so like that. So these things in terms of engaging in some sort of effort for human, because actually with the Buddha saying do no harm, actually it's do no harm and if possible do be a benefit. So not just stop there at do no harm, which is already a big task, but if you can be of benefit. So this is the foundation on which societies have built. We have shared values that we say, you know, these are the values that we as a society share, and if we all cooperate together and we'll get on very nicely. And to a certain extent, that functions. I have to say, in my little world in Ashfield, well, in my little world in Vajrayana Institute, we're very harmonious. Even people in other Dharma centres tell us we're very harmonious. So I'm not just saying it, you know, from our side, but other people comment. And I go, well, I got nothing really to compare it with because I'm not in the other ones, I'm here. And this thing of if we're in working for world harmony, what does that mean? What does that mean on a practical level? How do we do that to create this? Because it seems so difficult for us as a global citizenship to be able to live in peace. You know, we had the very inspirational, I can't remember the guy's name, but he had that vision of world peace, isn't it? Actually, his vision wasn't too great. It wasn't like world peace forever and ever. One day in the world where nobody picks up any weapons and shoots each other or bombs each other, or have this truce for one day. 21st of September. Now, when they launched it, they were launching it on the 11th of September. That 11th of September. So on the day that they were launching World Peace Day, the Twin Towers were bombed. So it's sort of, that didn't work, did it? As yet, there has been not one World Peace Day, 21st of September. I mean, people all around the world, you know, meditate together. It has a very beneficial effect, you know, in terms of creating a momentum for world peace. And I'm talking thousands and millions of people, and not, you know. But also engaging in many, many things. You know, they, one of the projects that this guy went on to do was, okay, he said, we're not going to achieve world peace, so how about we go into Afghanistan and get all everybody on that day checked for, it was a particular disease that was going on, I can't remember which one, but get everyone inoculated. Really practical, something really practical to do. A little bit risky, you know, like politically a little bit risky, but they managed to be able to make it happen, you know. So this is the thing of, we've got our vision of where we're heading towards. Now what practical, meaningful steps that will make a difference to the world, to people, to be able to do that? You know, we're not all Gandhis. You know, look at Gandhi. He was very inspirational. Ahimsa, you know, no harm, non-violence, and was able to achieve a lot through non-violence. I mean, we're told, I'm told by, you know, Dalai Lama and by my teacher Lama Zopa Rinpoche, do whatever you can for Tibet by peaceful means. So we can raise awareness, we can do education, we can talk, we could, you know, many things that we can do. And I think about Tibet, it's a very tiny little place, isn't it? And yet the world is aware of the situation in Tibet. And then I think of China and this whole thing. I mean, Tibet, China, Mongolia, all have long history together, most of which has been harmonious. So at this period in time, not too harmonious, at a government level. But the biggest population of Buddhists in the world is where? China, isn't it? How many millions of people? 44 million or something? Huge population of Buddhists in China. So we're only talking what happens at the government level. At an ordinary, everyday level, we have so much scope to be able to benefit each other, influence each other, help each other out. So that's, it's something to keep in mind. And as a Buddhist, then we take vows, don't we? So the vows of restraint that help us keep this thing of non-harm. No killing, no stealing, no lying, no sexual misconduct, no intoxicants. Or however many of those you take. At least the non-killing. Even that's hard, isn't it? I'm guessing nobody here is going around killing human beings in their spare time. But mosquitoes, ants, you know, cockroaches, not sure. I'm not going to go around and ask. But imagine if we said, we want rights for cockroaches. That'd be a tough one to promote, wouldn't it? I think they did very well with those two ant movies. You know, there were the ant movies. You probably had kids all over the world going, don't hurt the ants. And when I was in Copan Monastery in Nepal, and I had some orange juice in my, apple juice in my room, a, you know, sort of box of, or bottle, whatever, somehow the ants got in. And I thought, oh no, look at all those lives. I've just, you know, killed all the ants. I discovered a very, thankfully, interesting thing. Ants don't drown. Or if they do, it takes an awfully long time. I got out, I went into the bathroom, got out all the rolls of toilet paper and laid them out, because that's the only tissue paper I had. And poured out all the juice. Well, I couldn't pour it out without, you know, throwing them down the drain. So I put it all out. And one by one, the ants went outside. It took a few hours. And so one part of my mind was, this is going to look really silly to somebody looking on the outside. And I thought, no, you're in a monastery. It's not going to look silly. And if they were human beings, wouldn't we do everything we can to save their lives? So they are beings with minds. you know, past human beings, future human beings, who knows, but beings with minds. And so it's sort of like, okay, that's my little animal rights for ants. So there are things that, and now actually this university has its degree, isn't it? The law degree, animal rights. Yeah, I think so. Obviously no one here doing it, but I think in this faculty, I think it's one of the first to introduce that, where there's actual rights. Because in terms of that, look at what happened in Indonesia when, you know, when people saw what was happening in the abattoirs. Australia stops trade. So it could be, you know, the people coming together collectively and taking some action is quite powerful. You know, as a Mahayana Buddhist, I have bodhisattva vows. A bodhisattva vow is, you know, is basically you have to take whatever action you can. This is the thing about courage. So be a courageous bodhisattva. Take whatever action you can, not only to do good yourself or to do what's beneficial yourself, better than good, because good can have a judgment call about it. It's not about judgment. It's not about moral, you know, judgment. It's about what causes harm to yourself and others and what is beneficial. So we have to have discernment. We have to know the difference between what's beneficial and what's not, for a start. So what did I say at the beginning of that? I lost my little train of thought. Okay, so that's all right. We'll come back or not. Bodhisattva vows, that's what I was saying. Not only that, but I have an obligation to prevent, if I can, prevent someone else creating negative karma, if I can. If I'm able to do that, to prevent someone, which if I have a way of preventing someone dropping a bomb, I'd do that. I don't know that I've got that sort of power. I work with prisoners, though, and I, and many other people, I'm responsible for many other people, helping prisoners to tame their mind, and then they want to benefit society. It's sort of like a win-win for society, because they're no longer criminals then, are they? If they're wanting to benefit society, they're no longer wanting to, you know, take, get what they can. They're not motivated by greed or so forth. They're actually motivated by benefit. And I see this happen day, you know, this project's been running for 20 years, nearly 18 years. And you see the transformations occur. So it's a little drop in the ocean of, you know, of real habilitation for people in prison. You know, I never get when people say, oh, why do you want to help prisoners? You know, they should be punished. Well, they've got their punishment. They're in prison. They've been deemed responsible for a crime. They've been sentenced. They've been put into prison. They've got their punishment. They've been taken away from their family, their jobs. They're not allowed to earn money. You know, blah, blah, blah. Identity's gone. They're a number. And they've got time on their hands. And it depends how they use that time. We all have time on our hands. We're all in the prisons of our own mind. How am I going to use my time? You know, that's for me to decide. So first of all, we have to think about, well, the vows. I mentioned the vows. So whatever different vows that you have, of course, then I have my nun's vows and so forth. So a few more come along with that. For my mind, that helps because, you know, for all of us, if you've taken any vows or should you in the future, every moment, so for example, everyone can go around saying, I'm not going to kill, and particularly not going to kill human beings. But if you have a vow, hey there, if you have a vow not to kill, it's like when you're in a committed relationship. Like once, you know, you're not in a relationship, I mean, whether it's marriage or not, but at some point it's like, you know, you're going to be in big trouble if you cheat on the other one. That's when you've made a commitment. But until then, you're just dating or whatever. And so you can do whatever you want. But once you've made that commitment, and so every day that you're not cheating, you're strengthening that relationship. It's the same with vows. Every day you're not killing, stealing, lying and so forth, you're making those vows stronger and you're gaining a huge amount of merit. Merit equals power. Really. Real power. Not the sort of power that the government officials have, which they lose at the next election or whatever. You know, that's a bit transitory. This is real, you know, solid, ongoing power. So we have to look at how we think. You know, the first level of you know, if we're engaging in human rights, is sort of, or anything, our impact on the world is about how we think, how we act, how we relate to others, how we make sense of or relate in the world. You know, what are our big, you know, sort of visions for the world, for ourselves, for our place in it, and so forth. So everything that we say and do comes from our thoughts, doesn't it? Would you agree? Where else could it come from? Okay, it comes from our thought. The thought precedes the deed. The thought precedes the word. These, you know, words of the Buddha. So if we think about what sort of qualities would be valued in terms of the way we think, humility. Again, I could quote the Dalai Lama. I'm a simple Buddhist monk. Now, that's an act of humility. Did you think, really? If you're a simple Buddhist monk, yeah. So, and then he says, sometimes I catch myself out. I think of myself as a Buddhist monk. I'm a human being first. And he says, you know, we are all, as human beings, we are all the same. Physically. I mean, physically, we might have different colour skin, height, you know, short, tall, fat, thin, you know, all relative again, like long and short. So we might have some physical character, but our physical makeup, you know, we've all got the same sort of, you know, musculoskeletal, you know, structure and so forth. So physically our bodies work the same if you're a human. Mentally, emotionally, you know, we all have the same emotions, no matter what culture you are and so forth, all the same emotional makeup. So that hasn't changed. You know, what has changed is all external, language, culture, you know, the geography, the environment, unfortunately not always for the better because of what we as human beings have done. So having a sense of humility rather than arrogance, because arrogance and power, you know, this sort of lust for power, are pretty much the hallmarks of wars, aren't they? You know, that's my land. That's, you know, and I have power to bring in my troops to bomb your country or whatever. So whichever it is. So having this sense of humility and achieving great acts with humility and not, you know, big noting yourself, not to look good, but because it needs to be done. So this is one of the qualities. Patience. I think patience to get the job done, because we haven't achieved peace in the world yet. I don't expect to see it in my lifetime. It will not stop me from having the vision of that and doing what I can in my little, you know, sort of field of sphere of influence, you know, the ripple effect and so forth. Okay, we don't have to think, I'm going to change the whole world, because then we'll just won't even get off our seats and do anything, because it's too hard, isn't it? But what can I do? A hell of a lot, isn't it? We all can do a hell of a lot if we just think about, okay, what is my sphere? And just be patient. And patience is the opposite of anger. Anger, again, conflict, any sort of conflict, into family, interpersonal, in the community, in the world, and so forth. So, you know, cultivating patience with ourselves, patience with others, which is not like being a doormat. It's not like saying, oh, I'll just wait. It actually takes some action, But the thing of patience is that, okay, I'm in here for the long haul. You know, that sometimes in society people think patience is a weakness. It's actually a strength. Anger is the weakness. And people think, oh, anger's strong. The emotion's charged. There's a charged energy. But anger is weak. It's an unstable mind. It's very ineffective, really. What beneficial change has anger done in the world? Or in anyone's life? Think in your own life. Has anger ever got you what you wanted? Maybe temporarily, because people are scared of you. Maybe you've never expressed anger. Okay, someone you know. Road rage. As far as I can see, it doesn't get people what they want because you just see them at the next lights anyway. So, you know, just gives them a heart attack. And so, I'm glad for you to come in. I don't want you to have a heart attack. Having a sense of contentment. I mean, this was the underpinning of the Buddha's teachings. A sense of contentment, being satisfied with what we have got, not thinking, I need another country, another car, another property, I'll take yours, anything like that. So being content with what we do have. You know, one of the guys in prison, you know, we run these full-day meditation retreats, and this guy's been studying Buddhism for some years. He just took refuge a couple of months ago. And he said, you know, in prison, I was saying to a couple before, you don't need much, do you? I mean, we as human beings, he's discovered in prison that we as human beings don't need much. You know, he's got a set of clothes, he gets 3 meals a day, he's got a roof over his head, he's got a bed, he's got his study books, he's set up, he's doing his retreat, doing all his prostrations, doing all his practice. He's got it made. At the moment. He's got a lot of tough things in his life. And he's not in prison for, you know, having... He's in for a very serious crime, so, you know, he's got to deal with the consequences of that. But he's using that time to work with his mind, and he's content with what he has. He's not saying, oh, I want to have something else, because actually it's not available to him. So even his mind would just be discontent all the time. It's not fair, it's not fair, I'm here, I don't have this, I don't have a... iPhone, I don't have any phone, because you're not allowed them in prison, don't have access to the internet, etc., etc., look what I'm missing out on. Well, he can stay in that and be negative and bitter and twisted, but he's not. He's just getting on with the job. So this sense of contentment, the opposite of which, you know, in the Four Noble Truths, this dissatisfaction, this suffering, pervasive suffering that we have in life, that never having enough or never having the right things or always wanting more and more and more, this sort of lack of contentment, which causes what? Jealousy. You know, one of my teachers told us this story years ago. Her and her husband had got a new car. So the car was in the garage and the neighbour came and keyed it, ran the key down the side of the car. I think he did it more than once. And so, of course, what could she have done? Revenge. Right, you key mine, I'll key yours. I mean, maybe he didn't have a car, I don't know. But anyway, she didn't take that option. She thought, what does he really like? He really likes golfing. So she bought some golf balls and took them to him. And he burst out crying. He said, nobody's ever been kind to me. You might say, well, no wonder you go around keying people's cars, they're not going to be kind to you. Nobody's ever been kind to me. And then she heard his story, and he was like in the Nazi concentration camp, and he had a horrific life. So, but that had had a negative impact on him, and he was carrying that around. And then all of a sudden, someone's nice to him. So it opened his heart. So like that. So contentment, as the Buddha said, you know, the cause of suffering, suffering and its causes, you know. Cause of suffering ultimately is in our own mind, which is also the cause of our happiness, also in our own mind. So the sense of contentment, which is a better translation of sukha than, or satisfaction sukha, than happiness, you know, because happiness we interpret in so many different ways, which are not what the Buddha was talking about. This sort of lasting sense of contentment where you're not hankering over something you don't have. So like that. And that's a counter to greed, you know, of wanting something more. This dissatisfaction of the mind. I mean, look at, you know, tragically, Robin Williams. No matter how much he had, he was at the top of the game. World respect. You know, he had an Oscar. He had good family, nice house, presumably lots of money. Did any of that make him content? No. None of it was enough to transform his mind, you know, to deal with, you know, and then put on top of that addiction, which is what? An excessive attachment, a grasping at things. Alcohol, drugs in the mix. and already a mind prone to depression, and you know, and now he's dead. Took his own life, you know, from his own lack of contentment. So he said, it's an inner job. You know, so this is where it is. And then, you know, having a sense of joy, delight, rejoicing, as I said at the beginning, just take delight in the fact that everything has come together for you to be here. You have no idea how many conditions had to come together for you to be here now. Or for your whole life, really, to have the support you have. And that's from your merit. That's from your, you know, sort of positive actions in the past. Probably, you know, being great champions of world peace, being great champions of, you know, caring for others and so forth, practicing virtue. So this thing, we take these vows that on the one hand are about restraint. They help us, you know, set guidelines, and I won't do this and I won't do that. Society has its own guidelines. They're called laws. You know, and if you break the law, well, you suffer the consequences of that. So it has, for most of us, that has a tempering effect. I have to say, I did park in the car park down there and said I shouldn't park in there until after 7:30, so I hope I don't get booked. I slightly broke university law. It's not too serious. Anyway, I couldn't see anyone coming around to book me, so I think it's okay. So a slight bending, okay. But generally I do obey the rules because I can't afford to pay the fines. So, so taking delight in your own merit, in what you do, and in what others do as well, that can strengthen our confidence and our ability to feel like, I can do something, I can make a difference in the world if we really, you know, sort of take delight in what others are doing. You know, read the stories of people that inspire you, that have really, you know, the many, many stories of people overcoming difficulty. You know, we've got people like, well, you know, Nelson Mandela. I like to stick with the prisoners. Nelson Mandela, in prison for all those years. He must have done a hell of a lot of work on his mind while he was there. He had to have. Because look how he came out and was an effective leader just at the time when South Africa needed that. Nobody ever foresaw that apartheid would end, did they? But worldwide action over a number of years led to that. Berlin Wall, same thing. You know, it's gone. Suddenly, all this division, over. So there are, you know, there is hope for the world. Again, as the Dalai Lama said, the human race is increasing. We haven't killed each other off yet. No, I don't think he put the yet. I put that. So the human race is increasing, isn't it? So you would deduce from that there is more people working for the greater good than against it. Because after all, what distinguishes us from animals is our virtue, having a virtuous mind, having a mind that we can work with, that we can discriminate. We can discriminate right and wrong. We can discriminate what's beneficial, what's not. We can envision how to be in the world. We are very creative, imaginative, these sorts of things. What happens, you know, you think about the Cambodian War, for example, the Khmer Rouge, you know, killing off people who were like the professionals, the creative people, the doctors, the teachers, and so forth. Those cultivating creative people. That's the worst thing you could do for a country, is get rid of those. But it often what happens in time of war and so forth, because they're the people who do have the courage to speak out, isn't it? And not just the courage, the power to be able to do that, to have a voice. So if we have the opportunity to have a voice, we need to give voice for the voiceless. You know, there's an organisation in, I don't know if it's Sydney or Australia or New South Wales, called, I think it's called Voice for the Voiceless. Have you heard of it? It's for animal rights. Because they can't speak, they can't advocate in a language that we understand to against any abuse and so forth like that. Okay, so there are ways in terms of our thinking, how we act, how do we act in the world in a way that's beneficial rather than causes harm. I mean, if we analyse the cause harm, you know, it can be very subtle, can't it? You know, it can be very subtle harm, just a joke. I was only joking. Yeah. Can hurt. Can hurt. Can cause division. So, thinking about, well, what actions can I do that are going to lead to a better world? That's skillful action. What will lead to a better world? Number one, kindness. You know, primary. Kindness doesn't know a religion. Kindness is essential, really, in this world. Counteract loneliness. And look at the increasing loneliness. Everyone isolated, isolated. Maybe it's just because I live in a city, but it happens in country areas too. You know, the depression and so forth amongst the farmers in the country areas, males in particular, because, you know, we had all the droughts and so forth, they lose their livelihood. Not only that, they're actually quite attached to their animals, even though they're letting them go off to be slaughtered. It's sort of a weird sort of schizophrenic thing we have in our minds, you know. I love my animals, but I'm happy to send them to be slaughtered. But very unhappy if I have to shoot them on the property because they're starving and they're skinny and we can't get any food. Tragedy. And so there's a lot of, you know, there's a tendency towards suicide amongst farmers in Australia. And there's, you know, organisations, you know, Beyond Blue and the Masons working together to tap into this sort of network of farmers. Because they don't normally seek medical assistance. Males don't generally, so I hope you guys do when you need it. So being kind, you know, I notice that again with the prisoners. A prison is not a kind place. It's a harsh environment. To actually have a kind word spoken in prison is quite phenomenal. Has a huge impact. Never underestimate the impact of your kindness. You know, saying nice things. Just in my local chemist, one day I went in and got something and smiled, thank you very much, how's your day? To me, that's just what you do every day. And this woman nearly cried. She might have even cried. She said, oh, you know, most people don't even notice me. That guy before, I could have been like a robot. It wouldn't have mattered because not connecting human to human. How much a smile can do for somebody. Even they don't smile back. I find a lot of times people don't smile back. But it's quite a joy when they do. When they're open and smile back. So these are profound acts of kindness that are very simple and we can all do. We can all do, you know. Let alone any other kindness that you might do. You know, listening to people's troubles, helping them across the road, you know. Not being excessive and jumping in where we're maybe not welcome, but just having an eye out for opportunities to practice kindness, to be kind to each other and to ourselves. I mean, we can be kind to everyone else and then give ourselves torture. What point is that? So be kind with yourself. Be your best friend. Be your best friend as well. Speak kind words to yourself internally, you know. If you find that you have an internal negative self-critic, blah, 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 turn it off. Turn on the kind one. It's your choice. We can all do that. And that transforms your inner world, your inner world peace. And then we've taken this vow, some of us, of not lying, but even without the vow, you know, lying is generally not something that wins you friends and is not something that really is socially acceptable. So this sense of being honest, it's so much simpler, it's so much easier. It takes a lot less words to be honest than it does to create a contrived story that then you have to remember, what story did I tell? You know, I've got to keep that story going. And what if they talk to so-and-so and then they'll find out that story's wrong? It gets very, very complicated. Simplest thing, to be honest. Not this sort of brutal honesty. I'm telling you for your own good type of thing. No, not that. Just being clear, being honest, because that then your mind will be clear as well. And then, you know, generosity, dana. You've got one of those times coming up, haven't you? Do you? No? Somewhere else? So this practice of generosity, so that instead of harming each other, we're saying, how can I help? And especially, there's, you know, many examples cited where, you know, sort of people have had difficulty. I'm thinking of St. Therese of Lisieux. So she was, I think, ordained as a nun when she was 14. She really always wanted to be a nun. And then she was in a closed order, like this silent order. And so there was about 30 nuns altogether. So this was it for life. She's already 14, right? And she's got to be with these other nuns for the rest of her life. And there was one nun that she really didn't like. Everything this nun did irritated her. You know, they'd be saying prayers together in this mala rosary. The other nun would have a rosary and would make these strange clicking sounds at random. She never knew when it was going to come. And so she was like always on tenterhooks around her. So she noticed that she started avoiding her, walking down the hall, not making contact. She noticed that she was doing this. Of course, they were silent order. She couldn't declare world war. There's something handy about silence, I find, particularly in retreat, you know, because people don't get to hear what the rubbish of your mind is. Quite handy. Anyway, so she thought, I can't go on like this. She was right. So she thought, okay, I'll start going out of my way to see her, smile, be nice, give her things. So she started doing this, being incredibly kind to her, actually. So this was against her own negativity, or her own intuitive thing was to, you know, just get more and more resentful. Out of what? Just what was occurring in her own mind, not with, you know. So she clicks and does all this. So, you know, she wasn't disturbing other people. So anyway, she just continued to be nice to her, and this other nun eventually said to her, they must have been allowed to speak at that point, she said, why are you so kind to me? And of course she's thinking, if only you knew. It doesn't mean everyone that's kind to you, you know, has really got a problem with you. I don't want you to think like that. But try it. Try it with people that you have difficulty with, because it transforms. It transforms your mind. You're no longer... It does. Anyway, it works, is all I can say. It really works. So, because in the process of that, you have to transform your mind to think, how can I be kind to this person? Because it's not coming naturally. You know, all these other people, it's coming naturally. I don't have to think about it. But this person, oh, I've got to work on that one. And that helps you grow, helps you grow spiritually, help you grow as a person to mature and be more open. So very good. So this sort of acts of generosity that cut across our own, what you call it, you know, self-centeredness, selfishness. It's all about me, you know. It's all about me. It's not all about me. I'm only one person. And if I do the maths, there's, you know, how many billion people are there in the world? Is it 7 billion? Seven? Something like that? There's 7 billion. I'm this one tiny one. So if it's all about me, my world is rather small. And knowing my mind, it's not the best of worlds. So I'm much better. I don't know 7 billion people, but to at least think of, how can it be of benefit to others rather than what can I get from them? It's what can I give? What am I bringing to the world rather than what am I getting from it? It's a complete change. And it's completely, if you think about, you know, human rights, animal rights, environmental rights, just think if everybody in the world thought, what am I bringing to the world? You know, when I was working here at the university, I was working in Aboriginal studies. So traditionally, Indigenous people had this thing of, you know, they've got moved off their lands, and we won't go through the whole story, but traditionally it was, the intention was to pass on the land in at least as good a quality as you received it, if not better. Now, go tell that to our mining company. You know, you have to improve the land. I mean, there's a bit of lip service to planting trees and doing recycling of paper and that sort of thing. But it's not really coming from that same spirit of I'm a caretaker here of the land for my people and for future generations. So not just thinking about even myself or my community, my family or so forth, but thinking into the future. What legacy am I leaving, you know, for the future? So this is the way we need to think. What legacy am I leaving for the future? Because Indigenous population also had this thing of, you know, reciprocity, and everybody had a job, everyone valued, everyone. So there was no such thing as unemployment. Even you're disabled or anything, everyone had a job. It wasn't like, you know. So everyone had a role to play in society. So this is where we, this individuation that we live in, where there's a breakdown of that sense of community, hence the loneliness, hence suicide and all sorts of things that occur as a result, disconnected with ourselves, with each other. So the more that we can counter that, even our own communities, you know, helping each other, socialising together. You know, there's a big party going on down there. It was loud music, isn't it? I don't know that I'd want to socialise like that, but, you know, maybe you do. And then being aware of our speech, the power of our speech. Am I using my speech in a way that's beneficial? Am I using it in a way that's turning people against each other? Because that also creates conflict, creates wars and so forth. Just things that are said that are not true. I mean, whether they're true or not sometimes, but even they're not true. I can't tell you the number of things I've heard about myself that I'm just like, oh, really? Oh, somebody didn't tell me. So, you know, just really, yeah, not gossiping, not using our, not lying, of course, but using our speech kindly, you know, putting that kindness with right speech. That's not, one thing is that it's correct, it's not over-exaggerating and so forth, you know. Be really very mindful of what we say. And you see the opposite, like in schoolyards where kids can just torture each other with words. It's phenomenal what they can do. In the schoolyard, brawls break out and so forth. And, of course, then the other powers of speech that we have, for those of us who have a Buddhist practice, with our prayers, with our mantras and so forth, protection for our mind, let alone possibly protection for the environment and for others, you know, that setting up good vibrations in the environment, the power of the resonance of sound to be able to do that. We know the power of the resonance of anger, and we don't like it. It's a disturbing resonance, isn't it? But, you know, love, compassion, kindness, generosity, these are very beneficial ones to have, ways of speaking, connecting with people. So, thinking about our relationships with others. So, thinking about cherishing others. As I said, there's more other beings there are in this world than there is me, for example, only one. So, cherishing others, you know, really, this is where we benefit the most, actually. We benefit the most by benefiting others. You know, so we run these conferences, so people who come and happiness and its causes, and the people who come and volunteer, I like to say, you are the causes of the happiness, because you make it all come together so seamlessly, like at the Mitra conference and everything. All the volunteers come and they make it work for everyone else, and it's like, you've got the key, you've got the cause of happiness. And there have been studies done on, like, volunteerism and what benefit people get from that, from volunteering themselves, sort of thing. Isn't that contradictory? No, it's not. It's not. Because you're not doing it because I'm going to get paid, I'm going to get some status, I'm going to get awards or anything like that. It's coming from your heart. It's coming from your... I mean, you might be doing it to get some work experience, to be able to work in that area. Good. You can check it out. So treating others with respect. Treating others with respect. It's a wonderful, just right on cue. Thank you. Wonderful demonstration. So, respect, which doesn't, big note ourselves, it actually, at least puts us on, an even playing ground, if you like, or we respect others. We have in our mind training practices, to see others as greater than ourselves. It's again, it harks back to the humility, but paying respect, and this is a counter to things like the bigotry, the racism, the sexism, the religious wars, or in the name of religion, or so forth, and then the counters to that and so forth. The deprivation, really, of rights of people. For what? For an idea, one ideology or another. It's not being respectful of, being respectful of what we share, but also being respectful of our difference. It's fine. I mean, if we were all the same, the world would be a very boring place, wouldn't it? I frankly like living in Sydney, There's every food in the world available to you. For those that listen to music, there's every music available. There's everything available. It's such a wonderful, multicultural, rich to be able to share that with each other, and respect for all of that. As part of this Women's Interfaith Network, we all go to each other's places of worship, and we all do what the protocol is for that place. So when I'm in, the imam's place, I have to put a hat on, something on my head. And I think, oh, that's different, because in my place we don't put something on our head. So there are differences. But I'll do that out of respect for them. I won't go, no, I'm a Buddhist nun, I can't put anything on my head. It's just like, I'm in your place, I'll do what you do. So we do that. And I love, this mosque that, somewhere out west, huge mosque. And the people, we have this service and so forth, and everyone's very respectful, and then we have lunch. And the lunch is served by all the young men. They're all like teenagers into their early 20s, like some of you here. It's wonderful. It's like, oh, this is different. To me, this is different, because if you come to our place, it'll be all the women, because there aren't as many men around. Although we have one guy who comes and volunteers all the time, and he's the host with the most, He makes everything beautiful. But generally, so difference. It's fine. We're all different, so like that. So respect for ourselves as well. I mean, it's a reflection of respect for ourselves. And, the blatant, we just have to look at history for the blatant lack of respect for different cultures, for different, just Australia's history, without going too further afield. Pretty tragic. But for neighbours, for our community, for other communities, and also, again, working with prisoners, this quality of forgiveness. Because if we don't forgive, we want revenge. So I've seen those sort of in America, where somebody's convicted of a crime and the family and other, they should get what they deserve. They should, hang. Every state in America that hasn't already got rid of execution is talking about it. I think that's progress. That is progress. I'm excited because I deal with prisoners, and a few of them have been executed. Because no matter what they've done, as the Buddha said, there's no karma that can't be purified. So there is an opportunity in this life to turn that around. But you have these people, I want revenge. And you just look at them and you think, you're the one who's suffering. You are the one who's suffering. It's torment. One of our volunteers who visits prisoners in America, and you know, as a Buddhist, he goes in. He runs whole courses on forgiveness, because the reason he started visiting in prisons was that his son was murdered, and he went to see the guy who did it and forgave him, because he knew that this guy's suffering was only just starting. Of that, his suffering of that was only just starting. So he knew that this guy's suffering was greater than his own. You know, that family, MH17, you know, the one where the kids and the grandfather and the family were similar. It's sort of like forgiveness, and, you know, they recognise that, you know, we have more love in our hearts. You know, they weren't the ones shooting down the plane. Who have to live with that? Well, they're going to get a surprise, more than just this lifetime. They have to live with it this lifetime, but more than that. So they don't know that yet. So we can have compassion for those. You know, that's a motivating force. Compassion is action. It's not like, oh yes, I feel sorry for you. It's actually doing something, taking some action. So Andre, this guy who's visiting the prisoners, he now runs workshops for the prisoners to forgive themselves. Because they're stuck in, this is what I did, I'm therefore a bad person, labelled nothing else. And so they're recreating their own torment moment by moment. You know, I visit a guy at Long Bay who killed his girlfriend. He was in suicide watch. He killed his girlfriend, and then he lifted his T-shirt and said, this is what I did to myself, like immediately afterwards. And he slashed himself from here to here. Somehow he's still alive, you know, but it's all sewn up with surgery. So that's the physical, you can see the physical scarring, the mental scarring so much greater. You could feel it. You could feel that he was suffering enormous torment moment by moment by moment, not being able to deal with what he'd done. This is where the power of forgiveness can come in. And forgiveness towards ourselves for anything, rather than continue to beat ourselves up for the stupidest little things often. Well, I do anyway. We're all alike, the Dalai Lama said, so I'm assuming some of you might do that as well. Unnecessary, because we're just creating more suffering for ourselves. It's totally unnecessary. Kindness, forgiveness. You know, one of the lamas in Tibet who was, you know, locked up in prison, the Dalai Lama asked him when he got out, I think he was in there 25 years, and he said, did you ever think that you're in danger? And he said, yes, I sometimes thought I was in danger of losing compassion for my torturers. But he didn't lose compassion for them. Because he had a sense of, and this is where Buddhist practice can help us, because we understand karma. Or if we don't fully understand it, as the Buddha said, unless you're a Buddha, you can't fully understand it. But we understand the notion of karma, and that, you know, every act has its consequences. You know, positive action has a positive result, negative action has a negative result. Not only that, in terms of consequences in the world, but what are the consequences for our mind? That's what stays with us. Long after the act is done, that's what stays with us. We need that power of forgiveness, and then we do the practices necessary to purify that karma so we don't have to carry it with us next life. You know, gratitude, having a sense of gratitude. Years ago, I think I've stopped doing it recently, but years ago, every day, three things to be grateful for. You know, isn't there a song, Reasons to be Grateful? Yeah, I think there is. Maybe you're too young for it, most of you. But anyway, this, and I'd write down these things. It's a mind training to think of, you know, three things I stuffed up today. No, three things to be grateful for, you know, that I have in my life and that I've been able to accomplish today. So we're training our mind to be more beneficial and so forth. Also, as I mentioned with the, you know, sort of going into my pharmacy, my chemist, the gratitude that we can express to others, thank you, saying thank you. All they did was serve you in the shop. Yeah, it's their job. But we can say thank you. Somebody stands aside to let you through the door. Thank you. You know, and a smile. Really expressing gratitude. I was told that only in Australia do we say thank you so very much. But then I was in America and they were saying thank you so very much. I think it's catching on around the world. Saying thank you. Yeah, really. Things that are nice for people's ears. Having a sense of loyalty, although anyone of Scottish background? No, I'm safe. Okay. Clan loyalty in Scotland, where they've been fighting each other. Clan loyalty, my people, you know, but conflict with everyone else. And they've been fighting each other for so many centuries, they don't even know what the fight ever started about, but they just carry on the tradition. And what are you fighting about? We don't know. We're just fighting. Very weird. Not that loyalty. You know, loyalty to where your friends have confidence and can trust you and trust that you're not going to go blah, blah, blah when you tell them something confidential or whatever. That you'll care for them and so forth. So the world is constantly changing. We just have to look at the 20th century, 21st century, see that. 20th century, I mean, look at the amazing inventions and all the technology and everything else, and it just keeps getting, you know. What iPhone are we up to? What iPad? What numbers are we up to? Seven? Has it gone beyond seven? 10? What?
Six.
Okay, not seven yet. Okay. It'll be coming. Probably around November.
It's six.
So things are constantly changing. So if things are constantly changing, anything is possible. And this is where the Buddha invited us to think big, to not think it's not possible. Oh, world peace is not possible, therefore I'm not going to do it. Human rights is not possible, therefore I'm not going to do it. And this is where the responsibility comes. I am responsible to take action. I'm not going to wait for somebody else to take action. I've got to take action. Sure, you can join something else that's already going on, you know, raising awareness about this and that. But we all have this individual responsibility to do what we can for bettering our community, our society, the world, the environment, human rights, animal rights, everybody's rights. So people in a position of power, prestige, are able to use that in a beneficial way. I was thinking, you know, someone like Al Gore, you know, when he brought out that, it's a few years ago now, but Inconvenient Truth. And everyone went off to the cinema to watch it. Well, maybe not everyone. Maybe not everyone. But it got a universal, airplay, didn't it? So people start talking about the environment, of course, you know, and this is probably 40 years after, good evening, 40 years after when I was in university and, you know, movement against uranium mining and Friends of the Earth and all of those were going on. So it's a long haul. I mean, 40 years is not a long time. It might be in your life. But, you know, the Buddha was talking long term. So you plan like that for the long term, do what you can. So we set our goals, you know, aspiration. What's the world I want to see? Our aspirations. You know, in my practice I say prayers. Prayers are aspirations. You know, where do I want to be? I want to be a Buddha. I want to be enlightened. Hey, guess what? Not there yet. Long, long way off. So what can I do step by step towards that goal? Knowing that, you know, there's certain things I need to put into action. Same thing. We want a world that we want to live in. Step by step, we plan that. We plan the world that we want. I mean, after all, a whole lot of other people are planning the world they want. Politicians, corporate CEOs, whatever. Sphere of influence. So we can make a change. Nelson Mandela showed that. Mahatma Gandhi showed that. Many people are showing that. You know, we had at our last conference, what's her name? Jane Goodall, who worked with the apes. And she was speaking at the conference, and she had a couple of stuffed toys that she, every time she spoke, one was a monkey and one was a cow. And every time she spoke, she just sort of toggled them. And it was just a nice little reminder. Animals have rights too. She didn't have to say anything. It was just visual. So there are all sorts of ways we can affect people, raise their awareness and so forth. And Matthieu Ricard, a Buddhist monk, he spoke, you know, he presented graphically some of the awful things that happened to animals. Graphically. And I said to him, I know those things exist. I get them sent to me and they're on YouTube and so forth. I don't watch it. It disturbs my mind. He said, you have to watch. So now I have to watch, because he said, you have to watch. Because otherwise we become complacent. We go, oh, no, I don't want to go there. I know there's suffering in the world, but I really don't want to know about it. What happens to our compassion? What happens to our, you know, being propelled into action, because it does distress me and I just can't stand it. So I can't sort of stick my head in the sand. I've got to say, what can I do? And do what I can. Do whatever you can. It's all possible. Everything is possible. Because the only thing that limits us is our own minds. It's the only thing. Really. So, go for it. Whatever it is that you want the world to be, or your part of the world, your contribution to the world, just make it happen. I mean, everyone you admire in the world did that. And they went against probably the mainstream. Most of them got criticised and so forth. I always find it interesting, even the Buddhist stories. We love all these stories from long ago. But I reckon if I met some of those people I love the stories of, I'd be like running in the other direction. I'd be too scared, you know. It's like a nice story back there. But whoa, because it takes enormous courage to do that. So you just persist. And this courage, you know, courage overcomes fear. It's this building of fearlessness. Fearlessness. Which is what, you know, they say in the end, once you become a Buddha, you are fearless. Or even the great Bodhisattva on the path, fearless. You just, you don't worry what other people think because you're beyond that. I mean, you're doing the right thing. It's not like you're being irresponsible. Being responsible. We all have universal responsibility. Global responsibility, because everything we do affects people globally. I mean, the effect that you can have on Facebook or any of the others. Me, I'm only Facebook, and the only reason I'm there is because I don't care about, you know, what everyone had for lunch or whatever. It's about how can I use this as a tool, a transformational tool, because it can reach so many people. That's the purpose. Of course, then we have very tragic uses of the internet, which are not respectful of human rights, which is cyberbullying and all of this, where people go off and commit suicide as a result. That's happened from cyberbullying. That's a tragic consequence, isn't it? So, use the tools, use the technologies that we have. Reach as many people as you can. You know, one of our lamas, Lama Yeshe, who founded our organisation, his reincarnation, Osul. He says, don't call me Lama, I'm Osul. I never completed the study, so don't call me a Lama. I'm not a teacher. Lama means teacher. I'm not a teacher. Of course, he has taught. But generally, he studied film. He stopped being a monk because he said, I can be more effective in the world if I make films, because that reaches everybody. So that's his gig. I'm going to reach people through film. I'm going to be as effective I can in the 21st century. It's what's needed. So you work it out for yourself. What's the way to be effective in the world? And as they say, just do it. Being guided by, of course, certain principles, certain ethics. I mean, it just shocked me when, you know, there was this debate in Sydney. You may have missed it. About education in schools, you know, religion versus ethics. And I thought, there's something wrong with this picture. You either get religious studies or you get ethics. Like there's no compatibility. And just like every religion has certain values that pretty much we all share. There's a great foundation. I'm very grateful for my Catholic upbringing. It gave me a good foundation. You know, okay, I didn't believe that. The other stuff, but you know, it gave me a good foundation in values, in ethics, in how to be in the world. So this is the thing. We have principles that we live by. As I said earlier, we have vows, if people have vows, which help us, you know, live up to these principles, and being able to discern. And so this is, again, there's this culture in the younger, I think, what generation are we up to, like the ones in school now? What are they called? We've had YZX, I don't know, whatever they're called. Friends of mine who are teachers say, so not you, below, who are teachers say it's very distressing because the kids that think I have individual rights, but, you know, not interested in global rights, in anyone else's rights, just it is my individual right to, and they expect the world to come to them. I'm sure nobody in here thinks that, because you wouldn't be here if you thought that. So this is a problem for our age, because they're going to be the future leaders, some of them at least. So they're the future, and the teacher's going, what do we do? What do we do? That's why they're having this ethics education, because people have to learn how to live a principled life, a life of meaning. Unfortunately, that's where we are today. So religion or not, as the Dalai Lama reminded us, you know, what are you going to do? You're only going to look after the Buddhists, or you're only going to look after the people of any religion? That makes up a very tiny percentage of the world. What about the rest? So it's not about religion, it's about values that we share and ways that we can all work together for the greater good, the whole world, the planet. And then they've got those people going off to Mars, you know, isn't it? 50,000 people or something like that applied. One-way ticket. Now, I hope there's some psychologists, some scientists, some psychiatrists, some counsellors, some social workers, some people with, you know, sort of spiritual, you know, advisors and so forth. They don't have to be of a particular religion, but I hope those people are going there, because otherwise they could create a mess, couldn't they? And then they're going to try and create in Mars what they've done to this Earth. Poor Mars. Be warned, Mars. Stop them. Border patrol. So, given that we are all interdependent, and now globally, well, it seems like, whatever you call it, universally, the universe, Mars and all of that, and I don't know if they're exploring life on the other planets, probably are. I mean, when we stuff up this enough, we're all going to have to leave. So, you know, giving service in our community, as I mentioned before, volunteering, this sort of thing, because we need each other. None of us would be alive without each other. Not just your mummy and your daddy and all of that, the school teachers or everybody who housed and fed you, but the hospitals and so forth, everyone who provides your food. And that's a hell of a lot of people these days. You know, where it's grown and then it's shipped and, you know, and so forth, harvested if it's real food, and then, you know, packaged and so forth. Jane Goodall, when she was speaking at this conference, said they did a survey with school children who ate and you know, they had beef, and said, where does that come from? From the supermarket. Yeah. And where does it get to the supermarket from? Oh, they bring it. They bring it. And then she pointed out the window and said, see those cows? Yes, they're my friends. They're your friends? Would you eat those cows? No. What are you eating? Cow. They didn't join the dots. So this sense of interdependence, if kids learn that, the interdependence, then they might make slightly different decisions. Or at least, you know, make informed decisions. How what you're doing has consequences for the whole environment, for the animal realm, including the cockroaches, snakes, whatever. So, that's a sort of stepping stone what to do. A bit of work to go on with for questions. Have we got time? Maybe a couple of questions we've got time for. I know you have announcements come at the end, but anybody got any questions? Comments? Observations? Success stories? Human rights advocates? Animal rights advocates? Environmental advocates? Come on, somebody.
One question.
Yes.
For many
Oh, good.
I'll just ask Glenn a bit. Spoke to me. Sorry.
Got a bit of a cold.
You mentioned about how thought proceeds deep.
Yes.
And it has, we, so, but there are some thoughts that are subconscious.
Yes.
So for example, the way we digest our food, or the way maybe the stress mechanism comes up in the body. Something that we can't
control. Are they
thoughts? Because
there are biological functions.
Yeah, there was something I wanted to clarify.
So, for example, when you pay attention to your breath, the breath happens automatically.
Yeah.
So the thought isn't in the breath. So when you're paying attention, you're cultivating your awareness. You're not cultivating your breath. Your breath's just doing its thing. You're quieting your mind to cultivate your awareness. And then, so there are biological functions and you know, quite a lot, that just go on, chug on, do their thing. I mean, you can mindfully eat, as you probably know, and then you become very aware of your eating. You become aware of the taste and the texture and this and that, and you end up eating less if you're wanting to diet. That's the best diet you can have, because you're not... You're not changing anything. You're not saying, you know, I can't eat this and I can't eat that. It's just like, I'm going to pay attention to what I do eat and how I eat and so forth, and thank everybody who's provided it to me in the first place, and, you know, may they get all the food they need and so forth and so forth, this global interconnectedness. But the actual digestion and so forth is not a thought. They're functions in the body. It's not a thought.
Okay. So they're not intentional in a way, but...
The blood pumps around the body.
It's like on a technical level, it's like the brain is, or the mind. Okay, that's signals.
Yeah, that's the difference. See, the brain, like, and this is the bigger debate, the brain is not the mind.
Yeah.
The brain, apparently we need the brain to function, but even that's a moot point, because there's some people who've been born with very, like, almost empty brain cavities and are functioning very well. It's a bit scary for those people who think that you have to have the brain to function. They've managed to function without one. They can think, though. Their mind works very well. The mind is... I mean, generally, we say the mind is dependent upon the brain. Because, yeah, anyway, that's a whole big, big discussion. But, so there are neurological functions that are not mind functions. They're physical. So everything with the body and the brain is part of the body is physical. The mind is not physical. It's not matter. You can't actually open your body and go, oh, there's the mind. Let's see what we can do with that. Because it doesn't have a physical essence.
Yeah. I suppose why I'm bringing it up is on a practical level in the practice. I find that my relationship with the breath often is a reflection of maybe how I deal with commitments or
things
that I do in my daily life, because especially when I become more skilled in yoga and stuff like that, then I learn how to use my breath to send it to different parts of the body and to soften certain parts of the body.
Yep.
So sometimes I find that I tend to control the breath, like, because just now you were getting us to count how long, how many times.
Yeah.
Which determines how long your breaths are. And I find that I breathed really slowly and deeply because I wanted to soften parts of my body internally and stuff.
So you had another intention going on. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't doing that that watching, but kind of using it.
That's okay, you weren't following instruction, but that's okay. No, but you did have an intention, which is volition, which is the mind. Because when we say we're sending breath to these parts of the body, we're actually not. We're actually not. I mean, the respiration system...
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
...doesn't work that way. However, what we're sending is this more subtle energy, prana. And basically, wherever you put your intention, your focus, that is where that prana, that energy is. So you can think in your big toe or wherever you want to, and there's an energy there. But as for the big toe, breathing?
I have a question. You mentioned about courage, which derives fearlessness. What derives courage?
Confidence. What do you think? I would say confidence. Intention.
Confidence, knowledge.
Yes, intention. It's true. You need both. You need the wisdom that goes along with it. Because you might be... I mean, people do what they are called courageous acts, which I think are a bit idiotic. Like jumping from planes and bungee jumping. Put their lives at risk. So that involves adrenaline and, you know, I guess one form of courage, I suppose, or fearlessness in a way, but not wisdom necessarily. So, you know, for anything for us to be effective in the world and know what's beneficial and good, then we have to combine it with wisdom, which is on one level conventional knowledge, just knowing what to do. For example, I always like to use the example of, you know, can have great compassion for Indigenous people in Central Australia who have trachoma. But I am not an eye surgeon. So I could come in and go, I have great compassion for you. I don't want you to suffer. Here, let me treat you. Go away. You're not an eye surgeon. You're just going to hack me about. I don't have the wisdom component that goes with it. So courage then, could even say, needs to have the element of knowing your capabilities. So you've got the knowledge for what you can do, or what you can get other people to do, isn't it, if you can't do it?
So does that mean, because courage is derived from multiple forms of knowledge, that one...
I wouldn't say derived from, they're interdependent. So you need both. For a courageous act, you would need both together. The courage itself, I wouldn't say, is necessarily derived from the wisdom aspect.
Okay. Interdependent. So does that mean, because there's multiple forms of courage depending on the scenario and situation, does that mean that someone is never always fearless?
I think courage is, isn't it, a lack of fear. So that would be fearlessness, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but there's multiple forms of
courage. No, how it manifest in action is multiple. The courage itself, you could say, is the power or the intent that gets you moving to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a quality of mind, and then that comes along with, well, how is that going to manifest in action, speech or action? Courage to speak up, you know, when people are saying racist jokes and you don't like it. That takes courage, doesn't it? But you also need to know your audience. Am I going to be... You know, are they going to beat me up? Are they bigger than me? You know, just you assess the situation accordingly. And that's the wisdom comes in with it. You've got the courage. So you're not being a wimp, but you're saying, okay, I need to have the skillful means that goes with this to make it effective. And, of course, we stuff up and, you know, we try again. That's it. You keep on, never give up. Okay. I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much. Can I do a little dedication? So I'll say a little Tibetan prayer, and it's basically saying, may all the virtue that we've created together continue to grow and grow, be of benefit to others, to ourselves, and all those we encounter. And may all the good qualities that we've talked about this evening, may they can continue to develop, cultivate that in my mind, in my life, use every opportunity to be of benefit. Gewa dihi nududa alahama sange drubyune drohwa chikyang mahalupa deyi sala gupa shu jang chub sen chog rinpoche Ma ke pa nam ge gu chik, ge pa nyam pa me pa yun, gom ne gong du pa wa shu. Thank you very much. I might have a bit more.